You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. As we've been talking about this hour, it has been 3 years to the day since Flint's ill-fated switch to the Flint River as its source of drinking water. Then-Mayor Dane Walling pushed the button that ended 50 years of getting water from Detroit. A bunch of city and state officials stood around toasting the occasion with glasses of river water. They promised people shouldn't notice any difference, said, "This is indeed the best choice for the city of Flint going forward." Kurt Guyette is an investigative reporter with the Michigan ACLU. He has covered the Flint water disaster from the very beginning, and he's written a very deep dive into the source of Flint's water crisis for the Metro Times. Good to have you with us, Kurt.
So great to be here.
Your piece for Metro Times tries to answer some very important questions. Why did Genesee County need to build a new pipeline that duplicated what was already being provided by a regional system? And how come officials, local and state, bent over backward to get Flint to be part of this KWA, the Carignani Water Authority, ending 50 years of getting water from Detroit? Did you find any clear answers to those central questions?
No, we didn't come to a conclusive answer, but the way you described it, it was absolutely accurate. I mean, they were bending over backwards. They were jumping through hoops. I mean, right now, the Attorney General's office is prosecuting people for using false pretenses to obtain the loan that was necessary for Flint to participate in the construction of the KWA. The fact that there was extraordinary efforts made to do this, possibly illegal actions were taken to do it, shows just how deep the effort was to make this happen regardless of the cost. One of the other things that came out in that article was the fact that it's being alleged that one of the stipulations of obtaining that loan was that Flint would have to use the river. So, you know, that conclusively draws a connection between the crisis in Flint and the Carignani pipeline.
And when we first heard, well, Detroit cut us off.
Yes.
We heard that from Lansing, from the highest levels.
Absolutely. And it was just absolute lie. No question about it, that was not true. You're absolutely right. I asked Governor Snyder's then spokeswoman, Sarah Werfel, about it. And that's what she said. Oh, we didn't have any choice in the matter. Detroit kicked us off. You know, they took something that was true, which was Detroit canceled a long-term contract, but then added something that was not true, which in the words of one of the emergency managers was Detroit said, go find your water someplace else. That's not true. Detroit kept making offers. First of all, they wanted to keep Flint on the system in general. But then once the decision to go with the Carignani was made, they wanted to keep selling water. And we were able to prove the lie by a Freedom of Information Act request document that we got, which was a letter signed by one of the emergency managers, Darnell Early, rejecting Detroit's offer. So there was no question that it was a lie, and there was no question that they kept repeating it. Even after we proved it was a lie, they kept making the case, kept repeating the lie because they were stuck. They were the ones that made the decision, and they were doing everything they could to evade responsibility for that horribly tragic decision, to the point where they would tell a lie that was proved to be a lie. That's how desperate they were to avoid accountability for this.
Your Metro Times piece, Kurt, broke down two clear sides of this KWA question as you talked to Peter Hammer, Wayne State University Law and ACLU, and Jeff Wright, Genesee County Drain Commissioner and CEO of the KWA. Racism or trying to get Flint out from under rising Detroit water rates? Break that down more for us.
And there's various kinds of racism that Professor Hammer talked about. And really, the story was built around testimony to the Michigan Civil Rights Commission. Hammer presented a very long, thoughtful, well-documented testimony last June. Jeff Wright, the drain commissioner, came back with a response to that in November, really going after Hammer, very much attacking Hammer, whereas Wright was not really the subject of an attack in Hammer's initial testimony. And then Hammer responded pretty forcefully by coming back at Wright, getting into a lot of the issues. That testimony really did frame the two sides of the debate. The racism, certainly, there should be no debate that the structural racism that occurred, you know, the things that helped lead Flint to be in the position it is, it's undebatable. Federal subsidies for home loans weren't available to people of color. And so white people could move out of cities like Detroit and Flint, and black people were pretty much stuck. And then as the white flight occurred, it created kind of a downward spiral. You're losing your tax base, which causes a reduction in services, which causes more people to want to leave. You know, that aspect of the racism, I don't know how anybody could deny. It's so well established. It's just proved. But then Hammer goes further to say that continued racism sort of creates the opportunity to take advantage of these communities. Hammer didn't say it, but I would say it's not just racism, it's classism as well. And you see that throughout all the cities that were taken over by emergency managers. Almost all of them were majority minority cities, but they also all had in common very high poverty rates. These are communities that are marginalized for various reasons. You know, people ask, geez, would this have happened in Bloomfield Hills or Grosse Pointe? And the answer is clearly no. And the starting point is those cities don't get taken over by the state. You know, it's poor minority cities that get taken over the state. And one of the things that set these cities and school districts up for failure, but the cities specifically, were revenue sharing cuts. You had the issue of the crash in 08. So property values were decimated, and especially in communities of color, because the predatory mortgage industry targeted communities of color. So they were especially hard hit. And so their tax revenues take a really big hit. They're struggling just to make it. And then Snyder comes in and the revenue sharing, and it's like they're standing on the edge of a precipice and just got pushed over into this crisis. And then that justifies the state coming in and taking them over. And one of the things that they do is sell off their assets. Seeing this in a benevolent eye can be very difficult, especially for the people that have had this done to them.
When state officials, particularly the governor, at the beginning of 2016 had to kind of stand up and admit, yeah, we really, really blew it. Yeah. And there were all kinds of promises made at the start of 2016. So here we are almost a year and a half later. What's the tally? What has the state actually done for Flint and its people?
Well, I can speak to one thing that they're now going to do that is not voluntary, in that the ACLU of Michigan and the Natural Resources Defense Council brought a lawsuit, ended in a mediated settlement, but essentially now have the authority of a court guaranteeing that the promise that they are going to replace all the lead and galvanized service lines, that's going to happen. You know, previously there was a plan, but the people in charge of it said, well, we have a plan in place, but we don't have the guaranteed funding to make this happen. So that's one thing that is definitely going to be happening. But it is a mistake to think that that is going to solve the problem. There's problems with the damage done to plumbing with inside the homes on the one end of the service line. But then there's also the problem of the infrastructure in general, which is a huge problem, you know, the water mains. And it's a problem for a couple of reasons. I just heard last night at a meeting that because these water mains, which were also severely damaged as a result of using the corrosive river water without having the mandatory corrosion control treatment, Professor Mark Edwards from Virginia Tech, who played a key role in uncovering this, estimates that maybe a dozen years was taken off the life of the infrastructure, which is already old and in need of repair. What I heard at this meeting last night, 50 to 60% of the water that's treated at the water treatment plant never makes it to someone's tap. It's lost through leakage. That's what in bad shape the infrastructure is. So first of all, you have the cost of buying the water, treating the water, shipping the water that never gets there. And then that water ends up in the sewer system. So you're paying for it on the way out to treat it on the way out without ever having used it. That's one of the reasons that water rates for people of Flint are among the highest, if not the highest, in the country. The other thing is when those water mains break, that kind of shakes things up and then causes lead to get in. So it's a health issue there. The other thing is that the system is such overcapacity. It was built for a city of 200,000 people with a thriving auto industry. Now it's less than 100,000 people, and most of the auto industry is gone.
Right.
And so you have this huge delivery system without the customer base there. And so that water will sit there for days and days and days. And while it's sitting there, the chlorine dissipates, which allows the bacteria to thrive, which gets to the issue of Legionnaires, which was another consequence of switching to the river.
That killed people.
At least a dozen people, and probably many, many more. Bridge Magazine recently did a very, very good story showing there wasn't just a spike in Legionnaires' disease, there was also a spike in pneumonia, which the two can be confused. And so there's a very high likelihood, say probability, that there were cases of Legionnaires that were being misdiagnosed as pneumonia, and people were dying from pneumonia as well. And one of the reasons it was being misdiagnosed is because the warning was not being sounded about the spike in Legionnaires that was detected at the time and, again, is alleged to be part of the cover-up on the part of the state regarding all this.
Were you surprised, Kurt, when Merrick Weaver said she wants to keep the city with the Great Lakes Water Authority and not go to KWA?
I was surprised, very surprised, because last year the stance of the mayor was, I looked it into this, but these agreements, you can't get out of them. We're locked into it. And I thought that was that. And so it was surprising news. I think good news for the people of Flint in that they don't have to now go through another change in water source, very expensive change. Latest estimate is that it would cost more than $100 million to retrofit the water treatment plant to bring it up to speed to be able to treat the Lake Huron water, which is much less complicated to treat than the river water, which just shows you how inadequate the plan to treat the river water was. But we all know that prior to that initial changeover, the person running the water treatment plant said, if you do this change, it's going to be over my objections because this plant is not ready to do the job. But they were in such a rush to try to start saving money that they went ahead and did it anyhow. And as Professor Hammer stated, and we reported in our story, they could gamble with the lives of the people of Flint, and they did. And the people of Flint lost.
What's it going to take to keep Flint fatigue from setting in around the rest of the state? When you think of Lansing, you think of elsewhere. When they hear the EPA saying, well, you know, things are improving, use your water with filters. Oh, then how do you keep people from thinking, okay, then things are okay in Flint?
And this is the part of the story that gets missed. And it's unfortunate that it gets missed because it's so important and also so inspiring, which is that a lot of people get credit for helping uncover what was going on in terms of the lead. Mark Edwards from Virginia Tech,
Dr. Mona
sure. Hannah Tisha, they did crucial actions that helped bring this to people's attention. But the ground zero was the people of Flint themselves that refused to accept the lie that their water was safe. And they joined together and they fought and fought and fought and through their fighting found allies that helped them achieve their goal. Those people haven't gone away. They are still there raising hell about what's going on, about what their needs are. And so they're not stopping. It really is inspiring. It is too bad that that crucial citizen role, like when we were doing the test of the independent test of the water, that was a citizen-led test that did that. We helped coordinate. Edwards was providing direction, but it was the
people.
The people going out there, knocking on doors, collecting water samples, proving that it was done. I mentioned our documentary, Here's to Flint. A lot of that footage in that documentary is off of people's cell phones at meetings, recording things that then they shared with us. So they were acting as citizen scientists. They were acting as citizen journalists. And
activists.
They were citizen activists. They brought the whole package together and caused this awareness to occur. And they are still there. There are class action lawsuits that are going on. I need to point this out because the schizophrenia involved what's going on here is incredible in that on the one hand, you have the Michigan Attorney General who is bringing criminal charges against the people alleged to have wrongdoing in all this. On the other hand, the same Attorney General is fighting tooth and nail these people in court. They fought us on our lawsuit. You know, they kept fighting until they couldn't fight anymore and they eventually gave in. They are fighting now. We have a lawsuit that is attempting to get justice for the school children of Flint, saying that these kids have been damaged in a significant way. That damage doesn't go away, but what you can do is mitigate it through all kinds of services, all the support services necessary, all the wraparound services. And the state is fighting against that. They're fighting the class action lawsuit. I had a meeting last night, a town hall meeting, the premier class action lawsuit involving Goodman Hurwitz, Pitt McGee, Trishelle Young, who is a lawyer up in Flint that has been in fighting this from the beginning just because she's a resident and saw a need and fulfilling it. They were talking about like motion after motion after motion being filed to just make their lives more difficult and delay. Like someone said last night, their tactic previously was to deny, deny, deny. Now the tactic is to delay, delay, delay. And justice delayed is justice denied. So they're up against that. And you have the attorney general that is really right hand, left hand, completely at odds with each other and what they're doing. Here's another thing that is sadly ironic, which is the emergency managers that are being sued in this. The state law obligates the city of Flint to provide their defense. And so the city attorneys aren't defending them, but they're paying for their defense. And so you have the people of Flint paying to defend the people that they are suing in order to get compensation for the damage done to them. So there's a lot of bizarre aspects to this that become more and more bizarre as time goes on.
It makes your head hurt and your heart hurt as we mark this 3-year anniversary. Kurt Guyette, and you can find his terrific piece in the Metro Times, A Deep Dive into the Source of Flint's Water Crisis. Kurt's an investigative reporter with the Michigan ACLU. Thank you so very much.
Well, thanks so much for having me on and giving the attention that this issue deserves.